Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty.
I found the driver's name from a police report that had been filed in Florida 17 years before. The report was torn and creased and incorrect. It said, a boy was crossing the street on his bicycle, but there had been two boys in the road that day and no bike. It said, the boy was hit and his body was thrown 19 yards, but he wasn't thrown. He was dragged that far, caught in the dangling chains of the landscaping trailer hitched to the truck. It said someone fled the scene, but that someone was my older brother, Alex, and he didn't flee. He dropped the bucket of fish he and Jonathan had caught and rushed over to his friend, but the boy was already dead. Alex had just turned 15. This is the day we never spoke about.
Uma Thurman, reading an essay by Jessica Sensen Henriquez. It's called The Accident No One Talked About.
We were born 1 year and 3 months apart, but looked like twins with our rosebud lips and Irish blue eyes. Before the accident, we were inseparable. We had our own rooms, but often shared my bed when we were little. When we got too big for that, Alex started sleeping on my bedroom floor. In the dark, we joke about all of the things we could buy if someday we won the lottery. A house made of pizza for him, and an island full of monkeys for me. Alex told me ghost stories until I was too scared to fall asleep. He would reach up from the floor to hold my hand, letting go somewhere between midnight and morning. After the accident, Alex never slept in my room again. On the way to the funeral, our parents told him that what had happened was God's will, that this was part of a much bigger plan. On the way home, as Alex slept, they told me that maybe it was better if we didn't bring it up again. So when I heard Alex crying in his room at night, I stayed where I was, wrapped in my comforter, and I didn't bring it up. When Alex was 19, he dropped out of college, even though he had always been the smart one, the honor roll son, and I didn't bring it up. At 23, when he was first arrested on charges of driving under the influence, and at 24, when he went to jail for reckless driving, and at 25, 26, and 27, when he was getting high in the morning and drunk at night, I never brought it up. Instead, my parents posted his bail, I paid off his credit cards, and if he needed a ride or rent money, one of us came through. When none of that worked to change him, I took a different tack. I started yelling at him to grow up, take responsibility, stop drinking, start working, and go back to school. Then I would soften and say how much I loved him and how proud of him I was when he got a job waiting tables. And yes, I would help pay for culinary school, and yes, he and his new girlfriend could stay with me whenever they visited New York City, and no, there was nothing I wanted more than to see him happy again. When none of that worked, I still didn't bring it up. Until one night, when we were 30 and 31, and I offhandedly and uncomfortably asked over dinner if he ever thought about the day Jonathan died. "Oh, now you want to talk about that," he shot back with a laugh. And in that moment, I felt his fury over our silence. "You don't need to worry about it now." We had been communicating before we could even speak, but this conversation we didn't have words for. "Do you remember," I asked him, "when you were 7 and you got that awful haircut and then I begged Mom for a matching mullet?" He smiled but said nothing. "And how much you liked swing dancing when we were kids, so I let you practice all those dips and throws on me, even though I knew I would end up on the ground?" "I did that for you," he said. "You liked swing, not me." The point I wanted to make, but didn't know how, was that I missed sharing a life with him. Later, we both went home and let the silence continue to grow. I was desperate to reconnect and convinced that the only way to do so was to get as close as I could to the moment when his life split into a before and an after. I needed to talk to someone who knew what Alex knew, who had seen what Alex had seen. I searched the online archives of our hometown newspaper and scrolled for hours until I found Jonathan's name in a write-up about the accident. After a dozen phone calls, I tracked down the police report. They couldn't mail me a copy, but said I was welcome to come to the station and see it for myself. So not long after, I flew to Florida and did just that. Sitting on a swivel chair in the police station's cramped archives office, I ran my finger over my brother's sloppy teenage script, his signature underneath his witness statement. As I read, I could almost hear his voice. Traffic was speeding up. There wasn't enough time. I reached the sidewalk first, and when I turned around, Jonathan was still in the middle of the road. I saw him get hit. When the ambulance came, I had to go across the street and tell his mother. I wrote down the driver's name and later found his phone number listed online. By the time I was back in New York, I had thought of 100 reasons not to call, but I had to. He knew what Alex had been through. On the 6th ring, he picked up. "Yeah? Hello?" "Please don't hang up," I said. I told him my name and explained that I wanted to know about an accident he was involved in back in 1999. Two boys were crossing the street, and I was the sister of the boy who lived. "That choice was the hardest I ever made in my life," he said. He told me that by the time he saw both boys in the road, he was already too close. If he swerved onto the sidewalk, he would hit Alex. If he didn't, he would hit Jonathan. "All I know is there were two boys in front of me," he said. "I had to decide in that very moment, and it was so fast. I chose not to hit your brother that day." What kind of choice is that? I pinched the place between my forefinger and thumb. a trick I'd picked up in college to keep from crying. I said there were questions I wanted to ask, but it was all right if he didn't remember every detail. It was a long time ago. "Not for me," he said. For 3 hours, he spoke about his pain, his frustrations with his family when they didn't understand, about his lost jobs and addictions, about how he never married or had children. Talking to him felt like the closest I could come to holding Alex's hand again. I told him I wanted to find a way to take away my brother's pain. "You can't," he said. "But if you want to lessen it, you've got to listen." "What if he won't talk to me?" "Ask again," he said. "He'll come round, and once those words start coming, you'll realize that asking was the easy part. Listening is the hard part, and that's what you have to do." I hung up the phone, but didn't stop there. I tracked down the witnesses who testified in court, the on-scene paramedic, the emergency room doctor, and the nurse who sat with Jonathan's mother at the hospital. And the more I heard, the more Alex's story became defanged. A year after that first phone call, I met with my brother and told him about the people I had spoken to and what they had said. And his instinct was to confirm and correct each detail. That was my opening. And his. Later, I was able to ask what no one in our family ever had. "Could you just start at the beginning and tell me everything?" And he did. When I see Alex today at 33, I no longer see someone who is stuck in one memory. I see a father to two beautiful little boys and a committed partner to the woman he will one day marry. I see a man who works harder than anyone I know, waking up to go to the restaurant on holidays and weekends, because he no longer needs or wants the kind of help I offered before I learned that asking and listening are the most valuable of all.
That's Uma Thurman. She stars in the Broadway show The Parisian Woman. She read Jessica Sensen Henriquez's essay, The Accident No One Talked About. More after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Jessica Sensen Henriquez says that she still feels guilt and shame about the silence that grew around this accident.
I felt ashamed that I wasn't strong enough to stand up and say, "What's wrong? Can I help? I'm here. I care." You know, those words are so powerful. And as a young girl, I didn't understand quite yet the power that they had. And so to sit there night after night and listen to him cry and know that he was suffering and feel so hopeless, I think I feel a little bit, still a little bit of shame about that period. But, you know, at the same time, I am very forgiving to my younger self, and that's taken a lot of time to learn.
She remains profoundly moved by her conversation with the driver who hit Jonathan, and she says that when they spoke, she didn't anticipate that the driver would open up to her like he did, or that his experience would sound so much like her brother's.
There was so much similarity. There was addiction. There was losing jobs. There was relationships that didn't work out. There was alcoholism. There was, you know, just this pain that rippled through the driver's life that I saw rippling through my brother's life. And listening to the driver tell his story, it was just so emotional for me because I was listening to it as though it was my brother speaking.
But a few days after that conversation, Jessica got a call from the driver's sister.
She was very angry because her brother had come to her in so much pain, telling her about this phone call and what had happened, and it just stirred all of these things back up for him. And in that moment, when she was letting me know what she thought of me, all I saw was that she was a woman who was a sister, and she was doing or attempting to do exactly what I had done. She was trying to protect her brother, and she was trying to take away all of his pain. And so at the end of that phone call, she said, "Do not contact him again." And I had to say, "You're right." And then I let them both know. I assured them that I would step back.
Jessica and Jonathan's mothers are still friends, and Jessica says she thought deeply about the impact that telling this story might have on their family.
I really battled with the idea of how much should people have to relive? You know, just writing the opening scene, I was only thinking of her. If she ever reads this, will this be more painful for her to read than it has to be? I'm not sure how the family responded. They've not reached out to me. I've not heard a response from them. But I'm okay with the idea of somebody being silent and that not necessarily being a negative thing.
And how is Alex doing now?
Alex is beautiful. He is my favorite person in this world. And he has two little boys. And he's such a good father, and he's such a good brother, and he's just a good man. And I know that that has not come easily for him. And I am completely aware of the fact that he will always have to try harder than other people to be okay.
Jessica also knows that nearly two decades later, Alex is burdened by what happened that day.
When it comes to trauma, there is no end. It is part of you, and it doesn't go away. Even when it's faced, it doesn't disappear. That experience still exists in him. And I think the idea of removing it or trying to get to the point where you're quote-unquote over it, that is a really impossible aim.
Jessica says that the accident and her family's response to it has helped shape the way she's raising her own son. And she's learned one overarching lesson.
If you love someone, you have to ask what's wrong. And when they say nothing, nothing's wrong, you have to ask again. And if for whatever reason you stop asking, that conversation will never happen. And those conversations, this conversation in this story, it has the power to heal. It doesn't have the power to change history. It doesn't have the power to take away what has already happened. It has the power to heal moving forward.
That's Jessica Sensen-Henriquez. She's a writer living in New York City and working on her first memoir. After the break, more from Uma Thurman and Daniel Jones.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Here's Uma Thurman.
I feel that this is a beautiful essay about healing and about love. And I think this writer, she has an enormous courage and obviously a very deep love for her brother. And I think this is a story about how you can continue to heal throughout your life in enormously significant ways with an open heart.
Thanks again to Uma Thurman for reading this week's essay. You can see her now in The Parisian Woman on Broadway. Dan Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times, says that he chose to publish this essay because it explores the consequences of ignoring trauma.
In a way, it's a vindication of it's like never too late to talk about these sort of long-buried pains from childhood. And it's a real lesson in, as difficult as those conversations are, and as much as you don't want to have them, and as much as you want to think you're fine and just move on, how important those conversations are and how important asking questions of a kid who's sort of traumatized and may not want to answer the questions, but you got to keep asking. You got to give them a chance to talk through all that difficult material.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, Amory Sievertson, and Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.